WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
What were the stereotypes about why there couldn't be a woman anchor when you got started in the business?
There were no women anchors, and I was given two reasons. Number one was that women's voices were not authoritative. So if a male anchor said, "Good evening, there's been a fire today," everybody would say, "That's terrible." If a female anchor came on and said, "Good evening, there's been a fire today," they would say, "I don't believe that. Not from that woman. Her voice isn't authoritative. What do women know about fires except grease fires in kitchens? I'm not going to believe it until a man comes on." It was silliness. Then the other one was that women didn't want to watch other women on television, particularly at 11 o'clock when women at home were at their worst. They had garbage on their face and their hair in rollers, and they were tired, and the women at home were all very, very down. Up would come an attractive female at 11 o'clock, and the woman at home would be jealous of her husband's attentions and say, "Turn that woman off." That was ridiculous. Number one, women's voices were not perceived as authoritative because there hadn't been authority vested in them. And as far as women not wanting to watch other women anchor the news on television, how many had they seen? These myths had two things in common. Not one shred of evidence to back them up, all thought up by executives, all of whom were male.
So when you started anchoring, was the burden on you to prove that all these myths were wrong? It's a lot to shoulder.
Me and others, really. There were a few of us in the front line who went on as anchors at first. And yes, I always felt that we were part of what I call the every woman theory. If you have a job and you put a man in the job and he doesn't do well, you say the first man didn't do well, let's get another one. Put a woman in the job for the first time, the woman does not do well, and you say, "See? Told you women couldn't handle these jobs." Women couldn't. It became the every woman theory in broadcasting. So it was incumbent upon us. I always thought it's an awesome responsibility to shoulder just being afforded the opportunity to carry out your job on the public airwaves. And add to that the responsibility of having to prove yourself for everybody to follow, and it becomes almost crushing.
Do you think anyone in the industry believes those myths anymore?
I don't think they believe those myths.
Are there new ones?
There are new myths that have replaced them. The new myth is that women cannot grow old on television. Why? Because how many old women do you see now? Well, you say to that, just give us time. We were only afforded entree-level jobs barely a decade ago, which is why I wrote the book Anchor Woman. Because Anchor Woman was supposed to show that here's where we were when we started out with old myths, here are the changes we went through and the commensurate changes that were reflected in society, and here's where we should be going. The new myth is that women can't get old on television, when, in fact, since we were only afforded entree-level jobs a short time ago, we haven't had an opportunity to get the same degree of predictable, qualitative airtime to build up viewer allegiance yet. I predict that in another generation, some of the women now on the air will still be on the air, and some won't. Some men will, and some won't. It will depend not on their secondary sexual characteristics, but rather their ability, proven over time, to do the job.
Let me quote you a second, and this is from your book, Anchor Woman. "One is not biologically predestined to renounce one's femininity in order to be promoted to anchor." What does that mean to you? What do you mean now when you say femininity?
Femininity means you don't have to go on the air and act as though you are male to try to emulate a male presence on the air. You can be authoritative and be female. You can wear whatever it is you're going to wear on the street, on the air. You don't need to wear a man's jacket. You can be made up. You can look feminine. You can be feminine. You can still be authoritative. You are authoritative not on the basis of secondary sexual characteristics, but on the basis of whether you know what you're talking about, whether you're prepared. The audience will believe in you if you believe in yourself.
Do you think the image that you have now is different now that you're established and accepted than it was when you were first trying to prove yourself?
I think that in many ways my image is softer now, although perceived as tougher. I think in many ways I don't push as hard for authority because I'm at ease with my own believability. I believe in what I'm talking about. I believe I've prepared for it. I believe that I'm at a level commensurate with any man of my age, and I don't need to prove. I don't need to be to push as hard. But it's perceived as being tougher simply because I have more experience now.
Let me quote you again. You write, "I have a feeling that attractive people in the industry are considered bad journalists. Average-looking reporters are automatically given more credit." How have you noticed that? How has that manifested itself?
Well, it's my feeling very often that what you will see is you will see a woman newscaster described as NBC's blonde. You won't see Tom Brokaw described as NBC's brownette. You find that people on television, if they are attractive, are always supposed to be there because of their looks. If somebody is on the air and they're not attractive, somebody says, gee, that person must be a great journalist because that person's not really terrific looking. I think the looks question is the when did you stop beating your wife question in television news. Looks is part of it. It's a visual industry. It's not the major part, the overriding part, or the prevailing part. It's just a part of it. It's a visual industry.
Being very attractive, do you think that that's helped you?
I am what I would call average looking, but that begs the point. I'm in the job, and if you are dressed up at the time and television smooths out all the wrinkles, then terrific. I think that how I look has played a part. It has played a negative part in that there were those people who said, you are not credible because you are attractive. There are those people who said, I don't want to be interviewed by a female. There are those people who said, gee, I'd like to be interviewed by the pretty little blonde girl because I don't think she'll ask any tough questions. I think that probably the pros and cons balanced each other out and neutralized themselves. They each were neutralized.
I think that probably women are expected to pay more attention to their visual presentation than men are. And since women tend to have hairdos and men tend
exactly.
to just have hair.
Exactly.
Right, you have to get it combed and then there's makeup you're expected
right.
to have for TV. Are you given the kind of time
no.
to pay attention to that like you're expected to?
No. You are given some help. I mean, we at NBC, I have people who help me with that kind of thing. They help the men, too. Like men have makeup now for television cover, beard sticks, et cetera. Men have to have their hair sprayed. However, it takes longer for females. It's not because of television. It's because of society, as you said. A man can wear the same navy blue suit and change ties 3 days in a row, and somebody says, gee, you know, no problem. A woman wears the same thing 3 days in a row, and they say, that's terrible. Doesn't she have any other clothes? Television is a mirror of society. It's almost a paradigm of society. So therefore, we take the same values and the substructure that society overall has. And it is a fact of our society that women have to pay more attention to how they look than men do. You're right. They have hairdos and not just hair.
You wrote it that when you were at KYW that you didn't even have your own mirror and makeup room to do it. So you had to do it in, like, the public bathroom?
Right, right. That was because – but you weren't allowed to complain because if you said, gee – you want me to look good on the air and fix my hair, but you haven't given me a place to do this, they'd say, the men don't need it. You say, well, gee, well, yeah, quality, I don't want to rock the boat here. I'll go into the public bathroom. Now I say, no. There's a place for women in television. They have a different set of qualifications, and different things are expected of them. Give me the tools of my trade.
So you couldn't have said that at KY at the time?
I probably could have and did at the end. But by the time I said it, it was already pretty late in the game. And I had gone through several years of having to allocate extra time away from my stories in order to elbow the women away from the mirror that came in to watch the Mike Douglas show so I could get to the front so I could do my hair. I had to build in extra. I had to get up earlier in the morning so that I could start my day earlier so I could finish it earlier. And if I had a late-breaking story, I was in trouble.
Then you get it again, right, because people say you're vain for paying attention
right,
to how you look.
Right, exactly. It's up one side and down the other. You really can't. You will have to pay attention to your looks, but you can't look like you need to
Jessica,
or want to.
Jessica Savage is my guest, and her new book, Anchorwoman, is published by Putnam. There's a really funny story that you tell. There was a newscast you were doing that was going to have a top-to-bottom shot of you, and you were seated at a desk, and you wanted to make sure that you didn't accidentally widen your legs so that you could see through your skirt. So what did you do?
Well, it was an open set. Usually anchor people are seen as disembodied heads who exist only from the waist up, but this particular set was an open set. I didn't know what to do. So I thought, well, I'll wear slacks. And my mother told me that's an affront to a nationwide audience. You should at least get dressed up. So I wore a dress and taped my ankles together with double-faced tape. And everything was fine until the show was over and got off the air and I got up to shake hands with the crew and tell them thank you and fell over. You have to think about things like that. Men don't.
Well, women's clothes are so extraordinarily unpractical. There's the skirts, which...
Slit up the sides. These little teeny pointy heels that you walk around on.
Well, exactly. I mean, are women in the field, women reporters, are expected to wear heels?
I don't. Didn't at the conventions. I wear them if I don't have to walk too far. But if I'm going to go to the conventions, I wear running shoes. Fortunately, how would they know? Because you're so close into each other there that you just were seen from the waist up. I dress for comfort. The most important thing is you don't want to jostle the viewers by how you look, because then they're looking at how you look and they're not listening to what you say. I think that you need to be, your looks have to be just pulled together enough to be disregarded. If I'm obviously wearing some kind of strange shoe and it's going to be in the shot, then they're going to say, look at the shoe she's wearing. Isn't that something? In a situation like the convention, you can. In a conventional situation, you cannot, because you cannot wear other than what society expects you to be wearing at that time.
I think your period in Philadelphia at KYW helped, and the success that you had there helped kind of develop the notion of anchor teams as being the thing, especially in local newscasts. What's the difference to you working as a solo anchor and working as part of a team and having that whole chemistry enter into the performance?
It's tougher.
Which is tougher?
Working at the network is tougher.
Solo? Uh-huh.
Sure, because you don't have someone that you can reflect, someone that you can talk with. I mean, it's, if nothing else, if something goes wrong, you can't ad-lib with somebody. But it makes you stronger in that you have to focus through the screen more. You really have to concentrate on somebody else out there and developing in your mind a sense of that other person on the other side of the screen and trying to interact with and react to somebody that you can't see and focus on.
Yeah, you know, some of us here at radio talk about the differences that we'd imagine there'd be, since most of us haven't done it, between television and radio, because in radio you feel like you can perhaps more easily be speaking directly to somebody, and there's a certain intimacy with just the voice that must be very hard to establish with television.
Intimacy with the voice, and there's also you're in here alone very often. You're not now. There's one other person seated across a microphone talking to you or with you, and then there's somebody behind or in front of you, actually, in engineering. But basically, when it all comes down, you're right here and alone, and it's personal. Television has a studio with other things going on and people walking in and out and teleprompters rolling and shots and floor managers. It's tougher to focus in television than ever. And when you add to that a news team, albeit a good one, a good news team involves all the people on the set, and the people on the set involve the viewer into the family structure. Here it's one-on-one.
Well, you were lucky at KYW. The team, the anchor team, ended up really working out. But initially, I think the men were reluctant to accept you.
I think there was a reluctance because it was a female on the news, an unknown quantity at that point for them. They were very fair about it, and that they said, "Prove yourself that you can do the job, and we'll accept you." But they were the senior people, and male or female, I was junior. And so, therefore, it would have been incumbent upon me to prove myself had I been male in that situation. I was, after all, only in my mid-20s. And these men were in their 40s. And therefore, they had much more broadcast experience than I had, never mind that I was female. Added to that the unknown quantity of I've never worked with a female before. And it was my mind to prove and theirs to be proven to.
I think when I started in radio, I had the feeling like, well, you know, probably you go in and you prove yourself once or twice and then you're accepted. It seemed to me you had to prove yourself like between 1 and 200 times before any kind of acceptance was achieved.
Right. But really, I ceased after that point because I realized there would never be a moment of absolute certainty. The time would never arrive. That there'd never be a moment where I could say, I have now proven myself. Because managements change constantly. When I finally realized that the management changes, but the viewer doesn't go away. That if I continue just to focus through the screen and not down the hall at the management, over at my shoulder at the competition, that the viewer was a constant. That if I could remain a constant, the viewer would be a constant. And if I took care of doing my job the best way I could, reflecting the viewer's perception of what he or she wanted to see or needed to see more of, informed interest, convenience, and necessity, as the FCC says, if I continued to do that, then I need not worry about proving myself to colleagues or management teams or even being a competition.
One of the recent developments in news is the news consultants who, like if the ratings are low, are brought in, and the consultants, I guess, talk with the news director and maybe give tips also to the anchors and to the reporters.
Never happened to me.
Really?
No, it didn't happen to me. I don't know that I think if a consultant came by, I think I would have to investigate the consultant first, because before I let anybody interfere with my relationship with a television viewer and my journalistic presentation, I think I would want to know more about that person before I was sure I would want to take their advice.
So, but you were never in the position of having
No, I hadn't been. I wasn't in it. And even if I found myself in the position, I care that much about my on-air product. I care that much about the job that I do and the people that I do it for. I'm privileged to carry out my job on the public airwaves. I don't know that I'm going to let anybody give any input. Not that I don't take criticism or look for criticism, but I investigate the source carefully.
Well, I think the stations invest a lot in the chemistry that they hope will happen between people on a team. And at KY, I think that chemistry had worked out really well. Have you seen a lot of places where that hasn't worked out so well? Where I wonder how much, for instance, the anchor people are consulted about that chemistry, or whether it's just in the minds of the people hiring them that they think they'll look real good together. You know,
that's usually what they do. That's usually what they do. I think that a smart person, a smart management person, doesn't say, gee, they would look real good. He's got dark hair. She's got blonde hair. Or he's taller and she's shorter. I think that what they ought to see whether these people are able to, number one, respect each other professionally, let alone like each other personally. Chemistry is something that develops sometimes, just like it does in friendships.
What's the difference between the way the ratings are taken into account at the station level and at the network level?
There used to be a vast difference. Local news is very often in any market in America, local news is the only locally originated program the station has. It sets the image for the station. At the network, there are other programs, but increasingly, the news is setting the image of the network. And so, therefore, ratings are becoming increasingly important now on the network level as well.
What do the networks do to try to increase the ratings?
Try to make their programs and their newscasts reflect the public desire to know. They aren't doing anything like, well, sure they are. They bring in new sets, they bring in new people, et cetera, et cetera. But it's not the set, and it's not the presenter. It's the package. It's what's inside the package, rather, that counts. What is inside the package is the key element. If there is substance there, then viewers are going to go for that particular substance. They are not going to go and watch a newscast because it's got a brand new, all improved set. It's like saying you go to somebody's home to look at their furniture. You go to somebody's home to look at their furniture once. You go back to their home, if you're going to go back, because you want to see the people and talk to them. Not because they got a new sofa.
Do stations usually try to, like, duplicate the success of other stations?
Always.
Yeah.
Always. It's like products. You see, when Kleenex came out with a tissue, how many other tissue people came out with tissues? If you see a show on television that's successful, it's a Western. How many Westerns do you see the next season? If you see a news team that's successful, how many news teams like it do you see across the country?
Tell me what you think. You know what I think might have happened with you, that since you were successful as one of the few women who are anchoring, that maybe in Philadelphia especially, if there was another woman who was allowed to anchor, that she had to, like, look like you, you know, have your hair do and the same color hair. There was a lot of speculation about that. Did you ever feel that too? And if so, how did it make you feel?
I am told that was the case in Philadelphia. I'm told that's the case across the country. If it is the case, if indeed it be the case, it's the dumbest thing I've ever heard of. That's like saying, package yourself to look like this person. Don't do that. That's like doing an act. If you're making friends with somebody, you don't do an act. If you're going to inform, or you're going to hope to inform somebody, and you're going to hope to gain some credibility, don't be fake. People don't believe in fakes. They will know and recognize, visually if not intellectually, the real article. Be the best at what you are, and then do your job. Don't try to be somebody you're not. So if somebody is trying to copy, if there are people who are trying to copy, then that's wrong, because why would somebody go for the copy when the original is still around?
When you started in news, it was the time when not only women were entering, but also there was a new... it was much more important for men to be young and good-looking, to be kind of pretty on the screen. And a lot of the men who were chosen in that period are getting older. And I have a feeling there's probably new pressures on them, too, because they might be replaced soon by the kind of person who they used to be and who
it's
they
possible.
Are no longer.
If you are chosen on the basis of that and you don't, in the interim, develop some kind of viewer allegiance, then you'll be replaced. One of the functions of writing the book Anchor Woman was that some of the old stereotypes don't fit for women anymore, Some of the old stereotypes are now being fitted onto men. We're seeing a blurring of role distinctions, but we are also seeing the emergence of a new and informed television viewer who selects on the basis of the product or the person's desire to inform, and not on the basis of exterior packaging.
Jessica Savage is my guest, if you're just joining us, and her new book, Anchor Woman, is published by Putnam. There's a lot of confusion about like how anchors are chosen and what their real job is, because for the most part, what the audience, what the viewer sees of the anchor is that they're reading copy on the air. And I think most people don't know what the rest of the anchor person's day is like and what it is they have to do to help in assembling the news. Would you tell us a little bit about your typical day?
There is no such thing as a typical day. The only constant is change. But I write all my copy. I research. I do my own interviews. I report. I make phone calls. I read all kinds of newspapers, the wire services. As far as the anchor person's role, if they're doing it well in the current configuration that it is, that anchoring is, which is to bring to a focal point, to get attention, to make a cohesive unit out of a news day and collective pieces. If you have done it well, it looks very easy and glossy and looks like you're not working very hard because they only see 30 minutes. What they see is the tip of the iceberg of a huge day of involved work and preparation, maybe weeks of preparation. As far as the role of anchor, it will be, I think that I'm getting an opportunity to redefine that. Beginning January 17th on PBS, I will be hosting a documentary series, 26-week series, produced under a grant, the largest grant public broadcasting has gotten. 26 weeks of documentaries that will be investigative, that will go behind the scenes, behind the headlines. And the anchor role there won't be so much as to give 15-second little news bursts, but to set up the documentaries, to explain what you're going to see, to be the consummate viewer, which is really what the anchor should be, and at the end, to do a panel or to do an essay or an interview that says, here's what you saw, here are some of the people involved, or here are some people who didn't want to be involved in that particular way we did it. What do you think? And instead of answering questions, we pose them and give information and let the viewer make his or her decision on the value or make a judgment call. I think that's redefining the anchor role, and that'll be Monday, January 17th at 8 o'clock, and every Monday for 26 weeks.
As you mentioned, you write your own copy when you're anchoring. How much do you need to know about a story before you can write the copy about it or introduce a reporter's piece on it?
I am not comfortable doing a newscast unless I know that if the teleprompter blew up and the pages burned up and all I had, none of the tapes rolled, and all I had was a half hour to sit and talk, that I could give you for that half hour a summary of the events that transpired, the major events in the world today. I wouldn't do it without pausing, reflecting, a couple of uhs maybe. But a lot of pauses. I think that that is what I would be able to do. And until I know that I've arrived at that point, which means that I have to know much, much more than the 20 seconds I gave on the air. And until I have reached that point, I do not feel confident in my ability to communicate the day's events.
What makes good copy?
Good copy is that which speaks well out your mouth and listens well in your ear. That's it. What makes good copy is what we're doing now. Talking. This is what happened today. This is what we believe is why it happened. And here is somebody else who has the details about it. That's basically it. Short sentences, talking to somebody, not broadcasting at a mass audience. That makes good copy. Good copy is what is read easily and clearly understood, well communicated.
So you write in the same cadences that you'd speak.
Absolutely.
You're going to be speaking it.
Absolutely.
Is that part of why you don't want anyone else to write it for you?
Yes.
They don't really know how you speak? Or even if they do, they wouldn't get it quite right.
They wouldn't get it quite right. I have a writer. I have somebody who writes late-breaking copy. I mean, to think that I could write the entire show and write while I'm on the air is ridiculous. Late-breaking copy is written by somebody who gives me phrases, and I ad-lib around them.
What kind of phrases?
Well, for instance, they give me a headline phrase. I write a short sentence. In the Iran-Iraq war, 14 people killed. Iraq says it's this. Iran says it's that. We have no further details. Line, 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 line. And then I sort of make a unit out of it, emphasizing keywords.
There's something that you've given the name of the bad news, good news syndrome. Do you want to explain what that is?
The bad news, good news syndrome is this. The bad news is that 500 people died in a flood today. The good news is we have exclusive coverage. you're real sorry about 500 people dying in the flood. You really are. If you're any kind of compassionate human being, 500 lives is a terrible, terrible thing. 500 deaths. You have to stop and say, that's really awful. And, you know, these people had families. But but it is a legitimate news story, and I'm glad that we have the coverage of it. That it happened is terrible, that we have the coverage. It bespeaks our ability to get coverage out of that particular area of the world. You're not sure whether to cry or to applaud. And that's the bad news, good news theory. It points up one of what I call the gray areas in television. It's one of those things where you have to be compassionate enough to be involved and involve your viewers in the story. You have to be dispassionate enough to distance yourself enough to give the kind of fair coverage a story deserves. You can't be that emotionally involved. It's like being an attorney with a client or a doctor with a patient.
Was there ever a story where you were supposed to, get to the scene of the accident and interview survivors or something at a point where you felt that it was really crossing the line of voyeurism and you didn't want to do it?
Yes, I did. And instead of a woman whose family was killed in a train wreck, and instead of going and saying, how do you feel about your family dying? I merely stood on the lawn and said, there's a woman who has lost her family. I could go and ask her how she feels about this, but I guess if you think about it, you'd know. And everybody who thought about it did know. It is not that you don't cover a particular story, or that you ask off it all the time, but in the kind of treatment that you give it, the way you treat the people in your stories, the way you would want to be treated, the way viewers would want themselves treated.
I always feel that there's more news now than there ever was. I mean, in fact, there are more TV stations and radio stations and magazines. There seems to be a lot more sources of the news, and all the stations seem to have a lot more of it. For myself, sometimes it really drives me crazy because no matter how good your intentions are of keeping up, you'd have to spend like 24 hours a day reading and listening to things. How do you manage your information inflow?
I try to be selective. I try to read, obviously, the major dailies. I try to read some other paper from the middle of the country. I try to read stories reflecting my area of expertise or the area I'm working on right now, which would be politics right now, and then after that, the different documentary series. I try to restrict it in that way and do sporadic, spotty coverage of different things. But the average viewer, listener, or reader needs to do all three, view, listen, and read, radio, television, and print, and then make decisions. No one source is right all the time.
When you were a congressional correspondent, people lie to you all the time in politics. How do you arm yourself so that you're equipped to deal with the lies? And what is being equipped to deal with a fast-talking politician who's trying to get their message across and there might be a lot of mistruth in it?
Three corroborative sources. It is not so because an elected official tells you it is so. If an elected official tells you something is so, you don't necessarily doubt it. You don't go in there saying, I don't believe that. This guy's a politician, he's a crook. That's wrong. You take the information, you say, you realize that there's a vested interest here. Nobody calls you to tell you, I've got some bad news about myself, usually. You get opposing viewpoints. And you present all of that, all of the information to your viewer or listener or reader, and let that person decide what is the truth.
Say it's a really short report and you're not going to be able to fit all that in.
If it's something where the person says, if they're going to give you like a statistic like 5 million people in my state or in the tri-state area or whatever, something like that, are starving and it's the fault of City Hall in the city halls in 18 cities, you don't just go on the air and say that. You say, so this congressman charges this, or these group of congressmen charge this, but then you go and you get opposing viewpoints. And you can put that in 20 seconds just by saying, he says it's so, and these people say it isn't.
Do you think there's a political bias to network news?
No. I don't think there's a political bias. I think that there may be a bias against business, against economic stories. They're hard to visualize. We don't understand economics the way we should. It's tough to explain to ourselves, let alone to cull it down into a couple of minutes. You've got to get opposing viewpoints, and you've got to, and then explain it. And how you can't do that unless you understand it yourself, so you stay away from those stories. I don't think there's a political bias other than that upper educated people in our society tend to be more liberal and have had more life experiences. If it means that we are the people that then go up the ranks and become network broadcasters, then perhaps that is so. But very often I have found that I will go out of my way to go in the other direction if I feel I'm going to be too liberal, or if I feel I'm going to have a vested interest, or if I feel too sympathetic going into a story, I very often will pull back and almost go too far the other way.
What are the issues where that's hardest to do, to pull back?
Obviously, issues that are close to my heart.
Like?
If I tell you all the issues that are close to my heart, give me my best. I can't, if I target them, I've just X myself out of all the stories that I might want to do on those topics. If I feel that my own personal bias, if there is a bias, is so strong that it would make me not a fair, you can't be a subjective reporter unless you're a tape recorder, but a fair, or objective reporter unless you're a tape recorder, but a fair reporter, if it's going to infringe upon my ability to do that, then I'm going to stop. And I'm going to say, ask to be removed from the story. It has happened before that I have asked to be removed from stories because I felt that it was too close to home. I knew the candidate. I believe strongly one way on an issue. And I have said, here is my problem. Here is how I feel about it. Please take me off the story.
This is, for me, a very confusing issue because people who know a lot about any issue tend to have beliefs about it. So do you think that reporters and anchors should have points of view?
I don't think they should have. Sure, they should at home. But unless it's labeled commentary, you don't bring your point of view to work. I mean, you may talk with your colleagues off the record. But on the record.
So you can be fair. You can be opinionated, but fair.
Sure, you can be fair.
And the trick is, I guess, to not let your audience know that you have an opinion or what that opinion is.
Exactly.
Because then they'll think you're biased towards it.
You always know that you've been fair on a pro and con issue when both sides hate you. It means you went right down the middle.
Okay. I think it was in David Halberstam's book about the media that he said that a lot of people confuse objectivity with being in the center. And that if you were a centrist, then people would say, oh, they're really fair and objective. But they weren't the same thing, that being in the center was as much a bias as being on the left or the right. Mm-hmm. What do you think of that?
I think that that is probably a fair evaluation. I really do. Complete objectivity is not possible unless you put everything on television that you see and don't edit it. The minute you put an individual between an event and your perception of the event becomes altered. But we can and should promise, and the viewers should demand, fairness. You do your best to exert the salient points, put them in a logical order, and take no pro or con stance.
Say you have an issue, and there's really like 25 points of view, but to be fair, you're going to have like both sides. But really, there's like 25 different opinions that you can have. How do you decide which sides you're going to have, or how far to the left or to the right the representatives are going to be?
You try to find out who are those people most representative of the large. What reaches, affects, the interest, convenes, the necessity of the most of the people in your coverage area? What is it that your coverage area believes to be the spokespeople? Who are their constituents? And you find those spokespersons on both sides. And if there are 25 different sides, obviously you can't be, no community on any issue is divided into 25 separate subdivisions. It may be, but basically the through thought is maybe there are two or three opinions on the topic. Rarely do you find something so fractionalized in America that there are 25 differing opinions.
Jessica Savage is my guest if you're just joining us, and her new book is called Anchorwoman. You write a little bit about what's called happy talk news at the station level. Do you think that'll ever happen at the network level?
No, I don't really. I don't think it's even going to happen much longer at the local level. If happy talk news used to be the idea was good, by the way. The idea was instead of somebody coming on the air and saying, and now here's the sports. Here is our sportsman, Joe Smith. That people don't talk like that. They don't say, and now here is my neighbor, Joe Smith. You don't say that. You say, what's happening in sports today, Joe? I understand there was a big game at the Spectrum. That's perfectly fine. But people took that as a license to involve themselves as stand-up comics for a couple of years. I think we're getting away from that. I think that happy talk news, the so-called happy talk news, is dying down, getting back to what we should be doing, which is communicating and not talking at. That we're beginning to see at the network, communicating instead of intoning. But I don't think that we're going to see happy talk news at the network, no.
How do you decide what should be covered at the beginning of the day?
Well, events dictate that. Event coverage. News reflects the events that go on. I mean, I'd like to see, gee, it's a slow news day today. What do we have in the way of a good scandal? Or what do we have in the way of a good scandal, which is certainly a variance. What do we have in the way of a scandal that is newsworthy? What do we have in the way of a fire or a flood? Well, we don't have any fires or floods today. We just have a couple of dull political stories, and that's it. That's what you're going to use. Your treatment of the story may be such that make it more interesting. How we decide is dictated by coverage. Certain stories reflect trends. If we're going to double-digit unemployment, then obviously that's going to affect the minority vote, since the last hired is the first fired. And so you see, the minority vote will probably be an issue coming up. And you reflect trends. You find out, you get information, you get feedback from the audience, and that's how you decide.
There's a lot of stress, I think, in a position such as yours. How do you cope with that?
Sometimes well and sometimes not so well. What I do is I try to surround myself with a good support system, both at work and at home. And I try to, when I'm getting overstressed, back off. It's the learning when to pull back that is the toughest thing, I think.
Do you have, things that you do to detach from work and calm down?
Needlepoint, be with friends, run, take walks, be with my dog. Whenever I'm going to take minute vacations, just go into another room, close it down. No, I will for this 5 minutes take no calls and hear no voices. And I will be quiet just here, just right now. And that's what I do.
You say that it's very hard sometimes to have a relationship when you're in this kind of position, since, if the person you're having a relationship with is also in television or in news, and if they're at another station, it's sleeping with the competition, and nobody wants that. If they're at your station, that has tensions of its own. Is that a problem that a lot of people in news have?
Has to be. First of all, who are you going to meet? If your job is to cover the people in power, who are you going to meet? You're going to meet the people you cover in power, and you're going to meet the people you work with or for. That's your world. Well, you can't really go out and be with your news sources. That's not a good idea. You can't really go out and be with the competition. That's not a good idea. You can't really be with someone at your own station. It takes you a while to develop outside friends, but you learn to. And you learn to treasure them. And you learn to make your outside life your outside life. Your personal life is your personal life. And your business life is your business life. You have friends at work, but you don't have involvements.
I think contracts always seem so really inviolable. And if you have a 5-year contract with a network or with a station, that means you'll be there for 5 years. But what I've recently learned is that it means if they want you, you'll be there for 5 years. And if they don't want you, they can fire you.
Well, it depends on the contract. Some are called no-cut contracts, which means that the network can take you off the air, but they have to pay you for 5 years. But at local stations, usually it's a 13-week job security cycle in return for you promising 5 years of your life. Meaning if you want to go at any time during that 5 years, it's too bad. If they'd like you to go, you can go in any 13-week cycle. There's no mutuality. Few people get to prove that, though, because if you want to leave and they like you, you can't go. And you could sue them, but you don't really have the money to do that. So I think that it's probably it's like the reserve clause in baseball. It's non-constitutional, actually, because there's no mutuality, but it's the practice in the trade.
Did you want to get out of your KY contract?
Yes, it's a matter of record that I did want to get out of my KYW contract.
But there's nothing you can do, I guess.
There was nothing I could do, despite the fact that I had been promised that I could if I was unhappy. Well, the person I was promised, management's turnover. It's a tough lesson for young people to learn, which is that handshake agreements are handshake agreements with black and white paper and contractual commitments or something else. Either you have a handshake agreement or you have a black and white contractual commitment with the corporations. Corporations don't shake hands. People do.
It must be hard because if you protest a lot, your life could be made miserable on the job. So I guess you have to learn how to walk the line between fighting for what you want or what you think you deserve and getting along with management.
Exactly. It's the politics of any corporation, be it in broadcasting or in any industry, is always difficult. You learn. I was very fortunate I got to learn very young.
People frequently feel like they know someone who they watch on TV every night. How do you feel when you meet someone who's seen you on television for years and is just really thrilled at meeting you in person? What's that experience like for you?
It makes you shy because you don't know what to say. It's like someone knowing you really well and somebody coming up to you and saying, "Hi, how's your dog?" And you don't even know this person. It's kind of strange that the person knows you even have a dog, but then you realize it was written about you have a dog, so they would know. It makes you feel a little shy. It also makes you stronger in that you learn to get over your shyness.
You write that sometimes you feel like you're disappointing someone because they think that you're going to
be you're
like,
never quite larger than life as they always expected. You never quite look the way they think. Your shoulders don't touch the corner of a large screen. You're just, after all, a person. And we are in some respects recognizable, in many respects recognizable. And because we are not perfect as the shows that we may be on or the newscast we may be involved in, there's always a little bit of disappointment, I think. So somebody's always telling you, gee, you don't look like you do on television, or gee, you don't look like yourself, which are always, always strange things to hear.
Well, what was it like for you when you started working at the network and you were meeting people who you'd seen on TV for a long time? Were they what you imagined they would be?
Some of them were more, and some of them were less. But it didn't depend on television. It depended on the individual.
But was it as surprising for you, do you think, as it is for...
Probably not, because I sort of knew what to expect, and I was used to seeing people on television and off television, so I think it was a little easier for me than for some others.
Right. Do you think that the print journalists still feel a certain disdain for broadcast journalists?
It's always disdain. I think that they're divergence. It's a divergence. Different skills. Different skills. If you're covering something for print, it takes writing and description. If you're covering for television, it takes learning how to so-called unwrite, or how to let the picture carry the story, when to talk and when not to. They're separate skills. They fulfill a whole part. The parts fulfill a whole of learning to know, needing to know, informing. I think that the days when print journalists feel superior to, it's over with. I think that one is neither a prerequisite for nor superior to the other. They're part, as I say, of a collective.
Do you think there will be lengthened network newscasts?
I think there will be more network news. Whether it's longer, I don't know. Maybe instead of having an hour's worth of news after an hour of local news, maybe somebody will take a shot and put a half-hour newscast in prime time when some of the younger demographic audience breakdown people can be home to watch. I think you'll see more newscasts, I don't know when, and maybe longer. And it's because it's reflective of the public's need to know. The days when something happens in Iran, that you have to explain why it happened, that it affects them at the gas pump, it's over with. People know that if there's a problem in the Middle East, it'll affect them at the gas pumps. They are much more sophisticated, and their need to know is greater.
What do you think of network coverage of women's issues? Feminist issues and
I think
issues?
That we cover feminist issues the same as we cover any special interest issues. I can say I am, if being a feminist means that I am someone who believed that they wanted to do a job and went out and did it, and then I'm a feminist. But I don't necessarily go to look for the feminist point of view on stories.
What does that mean?
Meaning that I'm not going to go and look for what issues are supposedly the so-called feminist issues. I'll cover abortion. I want to cover this particular issue or that issue. I don't look for so quote-unquote feminist issues as something for me to cover. I cover the news. If the news hits on feminist issues, I cover them too.
I think black reporters are expected to believe in equal rights for blacks, and that it wouldn't be a real surprise to anyone on a news team if a black reporter
believed
or a Hispanic
in equal rights.
Reporter believed that.
It's no surprise to anybody that I believe in women getting an opportunity to work at whatever jobs they want to, as long as they individually prove they can do that. Given the I don't think that women should be pushed ahead so that we can have women on the air or women in the front office, but I think women should be afforded the opportunity to prove themselves and to get to that office. I believe in open elitism, meaning that anybody from any walk of life can come up through the power structure, male or female, black or white.
You've kind of reached the top at a time when people are usually like starting to head in the direction that they want to go to. Do you ever ask yourself, like, what do you do after you've done that?
No, I don't do that anymore. I don't look for goals. I instead look to each day to put into it what I can and get from it what I might, to give and to get out of, to put into it a feeling of caring and to get from it a feeling that I have cared. I no longer look to see where I'm going next. This industry changes so rapidly. How could I pinpoint where I'm going next when I'm not even sure where my field will take me.
Right. Well, I wish you luck wherever it is you're going.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I'm going out on the rest of my book tour. The proceeds of the book, in part, will go to worthy journalism students who've lost alternate sources of funding for their educations. I believe in the book Anchorwoman. I believe that it chronicles a change in our times, and I'm very fortunate to have an opportunity to talk about it.
Thank you.
Thank you.